chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, there'll be no doubt when you see you are. Grass makes heaven in the middle of it. Grass makes heaven in the middle. We are grass makes heaven.
Secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
This first hour we're going to cover current news and updates and so forth. And the second hour, the first 19 minutes of it approximately, it's an update with Stephen Kinzer and his book, Reset Iran, Turkey, and America's Future. And then the second part of that second hour is 39 minutes of a rebroadcast from October 2010 that Charlotte Littlefield and I did with Stephen Kinzer concerning this same book. He wrote this book about 4 years ago, and we did an intensive interview with him, 39 minutes long, and it was really eye-opening, and it was very prophetic about what's going on in the Middle East today. Well, now they're just flooding in to the Rio Grande Valley. My gosh, what's going on down there? I don't think anyone quite has a handle on everything or about all the different players that are involved in this Rio Grande rush for the border. We're looking at a lot of children in this case. Now, how did the children get up there? Are they going over with other relatives, or are there relatives on this side? Boy, I tell you what, there are just so many unanswered questions. Hillary Clinton is making a book tour at this time. She was in Austin, Texas on June 20th. That would be yesterday, Friday, here in Austin, Texas. And there's recent articles out just at the first of this week that states that the sales were not as expected. So her publisher is very, very disappointed in the book so far. They shipped approximately 1 million hardback copies, and they expected at least 150,000 sales in this first week, and they didn't get it. They got 60,000 instead, and 20,000, I think, ebook copies. So this makes it a bomb, according to professionals in the publishing industry. What we're going to follow this by is that perhaps the name of the book is Hard Choices, alluding back to her Secretary of State position. As Secretary of State, she wrote this book, I guess, because of all these hard choices. But did those choices that she did make, were they competent and well thought out, and were they good choices, or were they hard choices? Bad choices. It's going to remain to be seen. We've got a clip coming up here that appeared on 60 Minutes of Obama and President Obama and Hillary Clinton, and there's a lot of backslap going on. This particular clip focuses in on Benghazi and the debacle there. At this time, this interview was at the end of January. Since then, it's come out that they were all lying, the whole administration, about the video and so forth. So let's look at this in the perspective of it being at the end of January on 60 Minutes of this year, earlier this year. So here we go. Let's roll that, my engineer.
Hillary Clinton's final days as Secretary of State included one of her most difficult. On Wednesday, she spent more than 5 hours being grilled on Capitol Hill for the security failures in Benghazi that led to the deaths of U.S. Ambassador Chris Stevens and three other Americans, the biggest diplomatic disaster of this administration. The accountability review led by Admiral Mike Mullen and Ambassador Thomas Pickering found, among many failures, that Stevens' repeated requests for better security never made it to Clinton's desk. and representatives and senators pressed her on whether the administration covered up the nature of the terrorist attack.
The fact is, we had four dead Americans. Was it because of a protest, or was it because of guys out for a walk one night who decided they'd go kill some Americans? What difference at this point does it make? It is our job to figure out what happened and do everything we can to prevent it from ever happening again, Senator.
I want to talk about the hearings this week. You had a very long day. Also, how is your health?
Oh, it's great. It's great. Now, you know, I still have some lingering effects from falling on my head and having the blood clot. But, you know, the doctors tell me that that will all recede. And so, thankfully, I'm, you know, looking forward to being at full speed.
Right. I notice your glasses are...
Yeah, I have some lingering effects from the concussion that are decreasing and will disappear. But I have a lot of sympathy now when I pick up the paper and read about an athlete or one of our soldiers who's had traumatic brain injury. I'd never had anything like that in my family. And so, you know, I'm very conscious of how lucky I was.
You said during the hearings, I mean, you've accepted responsibility. You've accepted the very critical findings of Admiral Mullen and Ambassador Pickering. As the New York Times put it, you accepted responsibility but not blame. Do you feel guilty in any way, at a personal level? Do you blame yourself that you didn't know or that you should have known?
Well, Steve, obviously I deeply regret what happened. As I've said many times, I knew Chris Stevens. I sent him there originally. It was a great personal loss to lose him and three other brave Americans. But I also have looked back and tried to figure out what we could do so that nobody, insofar as possible, would be in this position again. And as the Accountability Review Board pointed out, we did fix responsibility appropriately, and we're taking steps to implement that. But we also live in a dangerous world. And, you know, the people I'm proud to serve and work with in our diplomatic and development personnel ranks, they know it's a dangerous and risky world. We just have to do everything we can to try to make it as secure as possible for them.
I think, you know, one of the things that humbles you as president, I'm sure Hillary feels the same way as Secretary of State, is that you realize that all you can do every single day is to figure out a direction. Make sure that you are working as hard as you can to put people in place where they can succeed. Ask the right questions. Shape the right strategy. But it's going to be a team that both succeeds and fails. It's a process of constant improvement because this world is big and it is chaotic. You know, I remember Bob Gates, you know, first thing he said to me, I think maybe first week or two, and he'd obviously been through seven presidents or something, and he says, Mr. President, one thing I can guarantee you is that at this moment, somewhere, somehow, somebody in the federal government is screwing up. And you know, and so part of what you're trying to do is to constantly improve systems and accountability and transparency to minimize those mistakes and ensure success. It is a dangerous world, and that's part of the reason why we have to continue to get better.
The biggest criticism of this team in the U.S. foreign policy from your political opposition has been what they say an abdication of the United States on the world stage, sort of a reluctance to become involved in another entanglement, an unwillingness, or what seems, appears to be an unwillingness to gauge big issues. Syria, for example.
Yeah, well, Muammar Gaddafi probably does not agree with that assessment, or at least if he was around, he wouldn't agree with that assessment. Obviously, you know, we helped to put together and lay the groundwork for liberating Libya. You know, when it comes to Egypt, I think had it not been for the leadership we showed, you might have seen a different outcome there. But also understanding that we do nobody a service when we leap before we look, where we you know, take on things without having thought through all the consequences of it. And Syria is a classic example of where our involvement, we want to make sure that not only does it enhance U.S. security, but also that it is doing right by the people of Syria and neighbors like Israel that are going to be profoundly affected by it. And so it's true sometimes that we don't just shoot from the hip.
We live not only in a dangerous but an incredibly complicated world right now with many different forces at work, both state-based and non-state, technology and communications. And, you know, I'm older than the president. I don't want to surprise anybody by saying that.
Not by much.
But, you know, I remember some of the speeches of Eisenhower as a young girl. You know, you've got to be careful. You have to be thoughtful. You can't rush in, especially now where it's more complex than it's been in decades. So, yes, are there what we call wicked problems, like Syria, which is the one you named? Absolutely. And we are on the side of American values. We're on the side of freedom. We're on the side of the aspirations of all people to have a better life, have the opportunities that we are fortunate to have here. But it's not always easy to perceive exactly what must be done in order to get to that outcome. So, you know, I certainly am grateful for the president's steady hand and hard questions and thoughtful analysis as to what we should and shouldn't do.
You know, there are transitions and transformations taking place all around the world. We are not going to be able to control every aspect of every transition and transformation. Sometimes they're going to go sideways. Sometimes you know, there will be unintended consequences. And our job is to, number one, look after America's security and national interest. But number two, find that where are those opportunities where our intervention, our engagement can really make a difference, and to be opportunistic about that. And that's something that I think Hillary has done consistently. I think the team at the State Department has done consistently. And that's what I intend to continue to do over the next 4 years.
Thank you very much.
All right.
Okay, did you see the backslapping going on and everything on that? I mean, my gosh, they just oozed, they just gushed all over each other. In a previous segment, you'd have to look at the previous segment to really see that gushy, you know, type of, oh, they just gushed all over each other and told, oh, we just happened to, we were, you know, rivals, and then all of a sudden we're bonded together now because we've been through some of the similar things and so forth. Now, this next clip is from a Fox panel discussion, and Britt Hume is the one to focus in on. It's about 7 minutes long, and he has a little criticism. There's a plethora of differing people on this panel. Some are friendly to Hillary, and some are not so friendly. And Britt was pretty objective on this, and he comes back and says that, no, he wouldn't agree that she's a great Secretary of State. He says that she's very industrious and very active, I think is what he was saying. But as far as being a great Secretary of State, no, he wouldn't give her that. So, hey, let's roll this. Okay, engineer, get that thing going. Thank you. Appreciate it.
I just wanted to have a chance to publicly say thank you, because I think Hillary will go down as one of the finest Secretary of States we've had.
President Obama asked me to be Secretary of State, and I said yes. And why did he ask me, and why did I say yes? Because we both love our country.
President Obama and Hillary Clinton in an unusual joint interview as she ends 4 years as Secretary of State. And we're back now with a panel. So apparently, folks, the president calls 60 Minutes, and he says to them, I would like to do an interview with Hillary Clinton. Now, what makes this so unusual is that in his 4 years as president, the only time he sat down with another person for an interview, Mr. Obama, was with Mrs. Obama, not with the vice president, not with any secretary, not with anybody else, but with Mrs. Obama. So, Jeff, one, what do you make of it? Will the chattering class here in Washington think this is a kind of mini endorsement of Hillary for 2016? And how unhappy do you think Joe Biden's going to be at 7 o'clock tonight when 60 Minutes goes on the air?
Well, he's definitely going to be following this. And he was probably in the wings on Friday when this interview has been done, sort of a listening in. But look, I'm not sure it's any more than just I think this is good for the president. Her approval rating is very high among women, among others. So why not sort of sit down in that forum? You know, the 60 Minutes forum has been pretty friendly to him in the first term. So I think it's not an endorsement per se, but it certainly sort of looks like that. We don't know if she's going to run for president in 2016. She's leaving her options open, obviously. I think one thing we saw this week on the Hill was that if she does decide to run for president, her approval rating is going to go back to how it was before. I mean, she's going to sort of come down to earth here on things. But if she runs for president, I think Vice President Biden will obviously not. There's a lot of chattering about him. Is he sort of keeping his options open? He had Iowans in New Hampshire, you know, Democrats over to his house over the weekend. I think that he is not going to challenge her. If she runs, he will not. Who knows, both of them may not run, but it's just a bit of intrigue.
Kim, why do you think the president, and it was his decision, why do you think he wanted to get engaged in this kind of an event?
Well, I mean, part of this might have also been to build on Hillary Clinton's progress this week on the Hill, and Benghazi sort of tried to put this behind us. She was actually fairly remarkable there in that she went in. The Republicans were fairly unprepared to move her off of her talking points. They had built this up for months. They were finally going to get the answers in Benghazi. Nothing really came out of that. They also didn't manage to put Benghazi into this broader context of the president's meek foreign policy, which I think is going to be important to them when they deal, for instance, with the Hagel nomination. So it was score one for Hillary, and I think this was an attempt to kind of build on that, move beyond it, talk about Hillary Clinton's legacy as a whole rather than that event.
Yeah, I want to pick up on that, Britt, because during the hearing, what struck me was the Republicans were tough on Hillary, on Benghazi. The Democrats weren't, but both sides kept on saying what a great Secretary of State she had been, and to praise her service. And here are some of the points that have been brought up, some of her accomplishments. She helped assemble the bombing campaign in Libya to topple Muammar Gaddafi. She helped assemble the coalition that imposed the toughest sanctions ever on Iran. And she established diplomatic ties with Burma. Question, Britt, how do you rate Hillary Clinton's performance record as our top diplomat?
I think those examples you cited would add up to a case for her competence. They do not add up to a case for greatness. After all, the groundwork on Burma had been done by the previous administration, and the administration properly followed through on it. You look across the world now at the major issues. Are Arabs and Israelis closer to peace? How about Iran and North Korea and their nuclear programs? Have they been halted or seriously set back? Has the reset with Russia, which she so famously introduced with the photo op in Moscow with the reset button, has that led to a new and more cooperative relationship? Is there a Clinton doctrine that we can identify that she has articulated and formed as Secretary of State? Are there major treaties that she has undertaken and negotiated through to a successful conclusion? I think the answer to all those questions is that she has not. And those are the kinds of things that might mark her as a great Secretary of State. She has certainly been industrious. She's visited 112 countries. Her conduct as Secretary of State has been highly dignified. She does her homework. There have been no gaffes or blunders. So I think she's been a capable and hardworking Secretary of State. But I think the case for her being a great Secretary of State is exceedingly weak.
Juan, was Hillary Clinton a successful Secretary of State? And how much does Benghazi and I, you know, writ large, how much does that tarnish her record?
I think she's been a very successful Secretary of State. I think that the industry that Britt touched on at the end has been impressive to people far and wide, that she's traveled, she's made the effort big time. I would say, contrary to what Britt said, that when you look back at this era in American history, you'd have to say that our efforts, started by the Bush administration to promote the democracy agenda, the freedom agenda in the Middle East, has been carried through. So Arab Spring took place under Hillary Clinton's watch. And you can say plus or negative in terms of the impact democracy has had. This weekend we've seen some of the flare-up in Egypt. But you have to say that in terms of promoting American ideals of democracy, she has been effective. When you talk about China and the reset button with Russia, I think she's managed those relationships. She certainly managed, as Chris Wallace pointed out, what happened in Libya. She certainly managed to build the alliances that President Obama wanted. She has not undermined this president. She has been an effective tool for this White House. He put together a team of rivals. And to pick up on Jeff's point, it has played to the Democratic base in terms of women and in terms of Bill Clinton, who became Mr. Obama's chief surrogate during the last campaign.
I
would simply say that those are examples of competent conduct in office, but you know, you look at those other, I mean, you mentioned Libya. How's that working out for us? How about all those weapons that came from Libya that are now in Mali? How's that working out for us? And what about Syria? How's our policy there succeeded in furthering the cause?
Well, you know, we've ended two wars under her watch, Britt, Iraq and Afghanistan, and she has been critical in managing both of those situations
You think about it. Look at the relationship that was required with in Afghanistan with Hamid Karzai. Who is a key figure, if there was one, in managing that relationship? John Kerry.
I think that you're underestimating Hillary Clinton and President Obama. Karzai was here just recently.
I get that.
Okay.
You can see now where there's a various opinion there about her, you know, Secretary of State career, you could say, or position. And did she or not establish any new, can you say that there is a Clinton, you know what I mean, stamp on this Secretary of State, you know, her tenure there, her 4 years there, can you say that she really put some kind of a stamp? Was there a Clinton doctrine? Was there something that really put her own stamp on there? I don't think you can. And with all this debacle on Benghazi and all those other scandals, the IRS, and it goes on and on and on, you know, Fast and Furious, they're just never an endless scandals coming out of this administration. And then look at this Secretary of State, you know, and they all try to paint her. They're positioning her for a run for the White House primarily because she's a woman, you know, and that's really a lot of your liberal Democratic women are really just coming in very, very strong. And then the other day there are faith voters for Hillary I saw on the net. That seemed to put out all of her kind and gospel words and scripture words that she related to Paul's scripture and John. And oh, it just gushed with, oh, she's so religious and she loves Jesus and she's just really, really religious. And I think she's far from that. The face I see is something else. Now, what recently happened in Iraq is that ISIS or ISIL came in out of the northeast part of Syria and started running through the northern part of Iraq, taking, one city after another. And they're even threatening the oil refinery. There's reports they've taken that now. And they're getting within 60 kilometers north of Baghdad. And we're going to run this clip by Russia Today. And what's really interesting about this is, why do we have to go to Russia Today? Why don't our media people, our mainline media, step up and tell us as much truth as Russia Today has been telling us? Anyway, let's run this clip and I'll have some comments.
ISIS emerged in Iraq right after the U.S.-led invasion and pledged its allegiance to al-Qaeda. Although the groups later became rivals, it has fueled the sectarian bloodshed in the country and proclaimed an independent Islamic State spanning Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, Palestine, and Jordan. ISIS has thrived during the ongoing war in neighboring Syria after gaining access to money and arms flowing into the hands of the rebels there. And now, after growing into a huge force, the group is marching on the very heart of Iraq. Let's take a look at that. Earlier this month, the militants captured Mosul. That was a key victory for them. But ISIS continued to press south along the main highway towards Baghdad. Earlier today, at least 44 people were killed in clashes between the army and insurgents just 60 kilometers from the capital in Bakuba. Joining me now is Dr. Oz Hassan, an assistant professor of Warwick University. Thank you very much for joining us, doctor. Now, here's my first question to you. Militants from the ISIS are closing in on Baghdad. How bad is this?
It's quite dramatic in the sense that what you will find is that if sectarianism spills out onto the streets of Baghdad, it's going to be incredibly hard to contain because you're going to have Sunnis and Shias fighting each other street to street.
Washington is sending a small, what they call a small contingent of troops to Iraq. How far will America go to deal with the sectarian tensions there? And can they deal with it?
That's an interesting question. Not least because the sectarian tensions in Iraq are part of a larger Cold War going on between Iran and the Gulf states, namely Saudi Arabia, Qatar and Kuwait. So the United States, if you know, it can send a protection force in to protect its embassies, and it can try to deal with sectarianism in Iraq, but unless it gets on top of this wider regional conflict, and namely really starts to deal with its allies in the Gulf, and stopping them spreading sectarian hate, then really, you know, events in Iraq are going to spill over into a much wider regional conflict.
Speaking of a much wider regional conflict, Tehran now has been is almost a key factor in this, with Washington saying that they could use some help from Iran, even the UK saying that they might resume opening up the embassy in Tehran. How key is Tehran in all of this?
Tehran is key. If you look at 2003, Tehran was actually quite active in its support for the for reconstruction of the Iraq war, but they were spurned by the Bush administration. The Bush administration was very keen to ignore their efforts. I think in this regard, getting Tehran on board to try and help decrease the sectarian tensions is fundamental. But at the same time as the United States, if it does go down that route and try that, it needs to be very wary of the fact that Iranian involvement is actually one of the key issues that has helped sort of alienate the Sunni population in Iraq in the first place. So it's a very difficult balancing act that the United States needs to pursue.
Can Iraq survive another invasion? I mean, the UN has warned today that this could be, Iraq could be on the brink of a much wider sectarian war. And Western powers don't, Western powers don't invade again, what's going to stop the bloodshed?
At this point in time, what needs to, the only way you can stop this is if, you know, the first premise needs to be that, you know, you need to recognize that it's not just ISIL or ISIS, as it's been also called, as the extremists in Iraq. You've also got 80 other Sunni Arab tribes, made up under the Military Council of Tribes of Iraq. So there's a much, you need to recognize that there's a much wider variety of actors whose interests have all aligned together, and they are now working with ISIL and extremists, whereas previously they actually helped protect the Iraqi government. So in that sense, one of the first steps needs to be to get those forces who have joined up with ISIS back on side with the Iraqi government, get the al-Maliki government to really recognize that the way in which it's promoted sectarianism is inappropriate and actually incredibly damaging. So in that way, there needs to be a much wider regional approach and a much more nuanced approach if this problem is going to be dealt with.
Dr. Oz Hassan, international relations expert from Warwick University, thank you very much for that.
Okay, you see the danger there of that expert? And also, you've got secular forces that are Sunni, and they fought. They're in the Iraq war on the side of Saddam Hussein. So there's Sunni, more moderate Sunnis in the Baghdad area and in Iraq that are beginning to join in with ISIS and ISIL. And this makes it a very, very dangerous situation. And with that change that has just occurred, we're looking at a something that could just blow up and just, devastate that whole area. Anyway, these are things to consider. We've got to keep our ear to the ground and our eyes on this Iraq thing. I don't believe that President Obama, he's slow to react. I know he had to move aircraft carriers in, you know, into position and other support craft to do any kind of bombing. But my way of thinking, they should have had some people on the ground or something immediately. Saudi Arabia is warning right now the United States and the UK, stay out of Iraq with forces. Tonight, President Obama has only sent in, I believe, 300 advisors. No major military force has been designated by the president to go in there yet. This next bit of information occurred recently. Dick Cheney and his daughter wrote an op-ed piece in the Wall Street Journal, and it featured, my gosh, it was very critical. The name of the article was The Collapsing Obama Doctrine, okay? And in that piece, Dick Cheney and his daughter, Liz Cheney, went after, very aggressively went after President Obama, and especially they're saying that now since he didn't leave enough troops there and this and that, that ISIS and all this is coming back, and this was not, you know what I mean, good foresight on the president's part and so forth. And then what's interesting about this is that they were asked upon the show recently on Megyn Kelly's Fox Network show, and she asked some hard questions. I'm going to play that clip right now. Megyn Kelly, boy, I've got respect for her. She asked Dick Cheney some really hard questions, and my engineer, let that roll right now.
Vice President, let me start with this. This is from one item in the Washington Post posted by Paul Waldman today. Quote, "There is not a single person in America who has been more wrong and more shamelessly dishonest on the topic of Iraq than Dick Cheney. And now as the cascade of misery and death and chaos he did so much to unleash rages anew, Mr. Cheney has the unadulterated gall to come before the country and tell us that it's all someone else's fault. The suggestion then is that you caused this mess, Mr. Vice President. What say you?"
Well, obviously, I disagree. I think we went into Iraq for very good reasons. I think when we left office, we had a situation in Iraq that was very positive. We made major progress as a result of the decision President Bush made to go with a surge in 07 and 08. There had been a dramatic reduction in violence in the country. They were prepared for negotiations that would lead to a stay-behind force of American trainers, technical people, intelligence, logistics capability, so that the Iraqi armed forces would be able to defend their own territory. What happened was that Barack Obama came to office, and instead of negotiating a stay-behind agreement, he basically walked away from it. Not only did the combat forces leave, but all of the other forces left as well. Our generals had recommended a level of 20,000 to stay behind. The White House said no and cut it ultimately to 3,000, and frankly, that was inadequate to do the job. No agreement was ever reached. But the result was an Iraqi military that was unable to stand up to the terrorists when the ISIS came in from Syria a few days ago.
In your op-ed, you write as follows: "Rarely has a U.S. president been so wrong about so much at the expense of so many. But time and time again, history has proven that you got it wrong as well in Iraq, sir. You said there was no doubt Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. You said we would be greeted as liberators. You said the Iraq insurgency was in the last throes back in 2005. And you said that after our intervention, extremists would have to, quote, rethink their strategy of jihad. Now, with almost $1 trillion spent there, with 4,500 American lives lost there, what do you say to those who say you were so wrong about so much at the expense of so many?"
No, I just fundamentally disagree, Megyn. You've got to go back and look at the track record. We inherited a situation where there was no doubt in anybody's mind about the extent of Saddam's involvement in weapons of mass destruction. We had a situation where after 9/11, we were concerned about a follow-on attack that would involve not just airline tickets and box cutters as the weapons, but rather something far deadlier, perhaps even a nuclear weapon. Saddam Hussein had a track record that nearly everybody agreed to. We had an overwhelming vote of approval from the Congress, more votes for the action than we'd had in the Desert Storm some 10 years before. Bill Clinton, Nancy Pelosi, numerous others spoke to the difficulties of the intelligence that all of us saw with respect to the threat that Saddam Hussein represented. It would have been irresponsible for us not to act. We did do the right thing, and I think the troops performed magnificently, and now we're in a situation where what Liz and I posted in our op-ed this morning is it's not just Iraq, but it's a whole pattern of behavior over the last 6 years that has refused to recognize that there is a war on terror, that we've got to move very aggressively to be able to deal with that, and this administration has repeatedly demonstrated that they don't believe it. Barack Obama has stated repeatedly the terrorist threat's gone. We got bin Laden. That's clearly not the true case. That's not the truth. And in fact, we have a situation tonight where terrorism is potentially in charge of a larger part of the Middle East than ever before in our history.
You mentioned that the status of forces agreement, and President Obama's taken a lot of heat for not negotiating that with Maliki. However, critics point out that it was President Bush who did sign the deal that said we'd get all U.S. forces out of there by the end of 2011.
With a status forces agreement for a stay-behind force.
And when the president, our current president, sought to renegotiate that, al-Maliki didn't want it. That's what the president's defenders say, that he tried, he wanted to keep some stay-behind forces that would protect the gains our troops had made, but Maliki made it too tough.
No, that's not quite accurate, Megan. What happened was our generals recommended a stay-behind force of from 14,000 to 18,000. The White House rejected it. So the military came back with a recommendation of 10,000. The White House rejected it. They took it all the way down to 3,000. I think by the time they got to that level, the Iraqis looked at it and believed that we weren't serious, that Obama was absolutely committed to completely withdraw from Iraq, and they were unable to come to an agreement, but I think in part because the Iraqis didn't think he really wanted one, and he certainly didn't push it. We have agreements like that with 40 nations around the world. They should have been able to come to an agreement with the Iraqis, and I think that failure to do so is what has precipitated the current crisis.
You know, there's no question.
It's a culmination of a policy that's gone on for 6 years now, and he has not been willing to step forward and have the United States play a significant role in the world.
Well, I want to ask you about that, because despite the fact that the Iraq War was so controversial and some of the items, in part because of the things we've been discussing, when the president came into office, President Obama and Vice President Joe Biden came into office, the vice president was celebratory about the situation in Iraq and said that it may be one of their greatest successes. That's how he described it in 2010, that Iraq could be one of the Obama administration's greatest successes, he predicted. Do you think, let me give this one to you, Liz, do you think that that is a game changer in terms of the political way this is playing out from all the people who want to blame the Cheneys and the Bushes?
Well, I think that what it demonstrates, Megan, is that there was agreement, there was unanimity when the president came into office that, in fact, Iraq was in a stable situation, that, in fact, the surge had been successful. President Obama also said, as a candidate in 2008, that the surge succeeded beyond his wildest dreams. So there's no question but that the situation was one where the president had a job, which was to negotiate a stay-behind agreement, to leave enough forces there so that we could provide the kind of intelligence the Iraqis needed, the kind of training they needed, the kind of assistance and support and planning that they needed to be able to maintain the gains that had been so hard won by American forces.
He wanted,
the president
wanted
didn't do that.
He wanted
now,
out.
Yeah, and if there's no surprise, frankly, that there are a lot of people now who would like to say, well, let's blame, you know, the Bush-Cheney administration for what happened. That's a pretty routine thing we hear from this administration. But your questions tonight, Megan, in large part demonstrate why we've decided to form this organization, the Alliance for a Strong America, because there's a lot out there that's being said, frankly, that is not true from this administration about the threat facing our country today. And we feel it's very important that people understand the threat that we face.
And I want to give you a chance to respond to that. I mean, obviously, these are questions that are out there and that are being raised, and who better to respond to them than you? And I know that now you form this group, and your group wants to reverse President Obama's policies, which I know you, Mr. Vice President, believe have endangered America's security. First, tell us why you think that, and tell us how you think, you know, this nonprofit group can do anything to stop a president.
Well, for one thing, Megan, we think it's an opportunity to get out and talk about these issues in a very objective fashion, to stand up and point out the flaws in the administration's current effort. Liz and I had the opportunity back in March to make a swing through the Middle East and talk to people I've been dealing with for 25 years since Desert Storm. And to a person, whether we're in Israel or in Egypt or the peninsula of Arab states, to a person, they now doubt the willingness of the Americans to come to their assistance. They don't trust us anymore. They were all very fearful that this president will not keep his word. And for years, they've been our partners and our allies. and now they believe basically that they can no longer count on that. They see the administration, they think, is supporting the Muslim Brotherhood, the group from which Al-Qaeda and Egyptian Islamic Jihad and so many others were spin-offs. And tonight, if you look at the possibility, for example, that Barack Obama wants to work with the Iranians to get involved in Iraq, that's something that creates consternation and fear among all of our friends and allies in that part of the world who think Iran is as big an enemy as Al-Qaeda.
Do you think that President Obama is dangerous?
Yes, I'll answer that one, Megan. I think there's no question. I think that he is unique in terms of a president who is sitting in the Oval Office who has made very clear that his desire is to weaken the nation. And whether you say it's his intent, whether it's naivete, you can now look at the results of the policy the last 6.5 years. And you've got, you know, the black-clad terrorists of ISIS now taking over city after city after city in Iraq.
Flying
You've got Al-Qaeda, 58% more Al-Qaeda, more Salafist jihadist groups now across the globe than we had in 2010. There's no question but that he's a dangerous president. And that we've got to fight back and that we've got to ensure that people understand the importance of American power in securing our freedom and security.
I have to leave it at that because I'm out of time. Mr. I'll give you the quick last word, Mr. Vice President.
Last word. In the last 4 years, there has been a 58% increase in the number of jihadist groups around the world. That's according to a RAND Corporation study. Came out 2 weeks ago. There's a dramatic increase in terrorism, a dramatic increase in their capability, and the president who refuses to recognize that there is such a thing as a war on terror.
Thank you, Wilson.
Well, that was Dick Cheney and Liz Cheney. And they didn't have a lot to say as far as I'm concerned. Attack, attack, attack. That's about all they can do, really. But to really make sense out of this thing, I don't see it. There is an interesting note here about Liz Cheney, Dick Cheney's daughter, was that she was one of three founders of Keep America Safe. The other founder was William Crystal, Bill Crystal, and then Deborah Burlingame. And Burlingame was the... is the sister of the reported pilot, the American Airlines pilot, that lost his life crashing into the Pentagon. Of course, as far as I'm concerned, that's very, very controversial and probably did not happen. So what's interesting here is we have Liz Cheney, whose father presided over the 9/11, you could say, event in the White House. And then later on, Liz Cheney, along with Bill Crystal, who is an avowed self-proclaimed neocon, along with Deborah Burlingame, would establish Keep America Safe. Deborah Burlingame, like I said just a minute ago, is the sister of Captain Burlingame, who supposedly lost his life on the American Airlines plane that crashed into the Pentagon. But that's highly disputed. In my opinion, it didn't occur. So the real problem here is to see that Burlingame was hustled to a large extent in to this founding or being a director later, if that's the case, of Keep America Safe, which was an attack dog type of organization against Obama. Now, you know, Dick Cheney and his daughter wrote this op-ed piece in the Wall Street Journal attacking Obama for being wrong in most cases. And then, you know, later Liz would, after 9/11, would invite her into this very wicked circumstance as far as I'm concerned. And Burlingame, if she is not awake yet, I hope she does. I pray that Deborah Burlingame will wake up to this vicious game that's being played, and not, you know, and taking advantage of her brother and that whole mythology. But Deborah Burlingame, I care about you much more than Dick Cheney or Liz Cheney could ever care about you. The next clip, next controversy that's still going on is the IRS. My gosh. We had the commissioner of IRS testify just recently, Koskinen, Commissioner Koskinen, and he testified before a congressional committee, Representative Camp, and then Representative Paul Ryan both questioned him. We're going to play those clips one after the other, and then we're going to talk a little bit about those. So here we go. Okay, my engineer, let's get those two clips lined up. And this is about the controversy of Tea Party, and really what they're doing is questioning him about these lost emails. So let's let her rip, engineer. Thank you.
We are committed to continuing to working cooperatively and transparently with you, this committee, and we will continue to provide you with updates. This concludes my testimony. I'd be happy to take your questions.
Well, thank you. What I didn't hear in that was an apology to this committee.
I don't think an apology is owed. There not a single email has been lost since the start of this investigation. Every email has been preserved that we have. We have produced or will produce by the end of this.
You don't think the time period between January 2009 and April 2011 is relevant to this investigation?
It is a very relevant time frame.
All right. Well, let me ask you this. The letter we received from the IRS on Friday the 13th admitted that Lerner emails were lost for this 2.5-year period.
They were lost off.
But you didn't.
They were
didn't.
Lost off her hard drive. We also advised.
Let me finish. I'm not finished with my question, and I'll give you an opportunity to answer.
That's fine.
But you failed to explain the timeline of events that led to that admission. And my question to you is, from the interviews that we've had, Deputy Chief of Information, the Deputy Chief Information Officer for the IRS, I'm told that the IRS knew as early as February that her computer crash supposedly caused the loss of her emails during the time period of January 2009 to 2011. Has the IRS known since February?
The IRS is knew in February there was an issue. As noted, we all had emails from Ms. Lerner last fall in which she recited that she had had a hard drive crash.
So in February you knew the emails were missing?
No. In February what we knew was there was a problem because we were looking at it from the standpoint of what the time frame was in which her emails appeared, and it appeared that there were not enough emails in that time frame.
So why didn't the IRS notify Congress at that time there was a problem with the potential loss of the emails we were investigating?
Because I thought it was important, it was my decision, that we complete the investigation so we could fully advise you as what the situation was.
Now, I got a letter from the White House 2 days ago that says that Treasury contacted the White House in April of this year to tell them about the lost emails. Who told the Treasury Department?
Pardon?
Who told the Treasury Department? The letter I received from the White House says that Treasury told them in April of 2014. So my question is, who told the Treasury Department?
My understanding only from that letter, which I have seen, which does not say that emails have been lost, my understanding of the letter says that someone in the General Counsel's office at the IRS informed the General Counsel's office at Treasury that there was an issue and the IRS was investigating.
No, the letter says that Treasury was told, that Treasury told the White House. We also have a letter from Treasury that says they learned in April of 2014. Who told Treasury? And do you know who in Treasury told the White House?
I have no idea. I have no communications with the White House.
Well, you're the head of the IRS. You don't know something this important? Contacts between your agency and the executive branch? You're unaware of them?
We are part of the executive branch. We have regular communications with issue regulations. We review them. We're in the process of reviewing, for instance, the regulations on the 501C issue. We have regular communication, particularly between our counsel's office and the Treasury Council.
IRS knew in February or maybe even March, and Treasury and White House knew at least in April, but Congress and the American people didn't find out till June, were you purposely not telling us? No, were you purposely not revealing this to the American people?
As I told you, my proposal was, and in fact our original thought was, to complete the Lois Lerner email production, complete the review of what other custodians had a problem, and produce a report to you laying it all out.
So why did the IRS inform the executive branch agencies, the White House, the administration, but kept it secret from the Congress, who was conducting an investigation?
We were not keeping it a secret. It was our public report to you that has, in fact, provided you this information. There's been no attempt to keep it a secret. My position has been that when we provide information, we should provide it completely. If we provide you incomplete information, people sometimes are tempted to leap to the wrong conclusion, not based on any facts. So we thought it would be important to give you the full description.
It's okay for them to leap to a conclusion.
Pardon?
It's okay for the White House and Treasury to leap to a conclusion 6 weeks before the Congress. But my question also is, have there been discussions within the IRS about when to reveal this information to Congress?
Certainly.
And obviously, these discussions included Treasury.
No.
Well, then how did Treasury find out about it?
Treasury, in a conversation I'm not aware of, apparently the first time I knew about that was that White House.
I'll have a lot of questions to write to you, have a follow-up with you. This is completely unacceptable.
Can I answer that question and make the record?
Well, I don't think you're giving me an answer, and I want to move on to another topic.
All right.
Your letter describes the Lois Lerner emails as being unrecoverable.
Correct.
But fails to mention where the damaged hard drive is today. Do you know where the actual hard drive is that crashed in 2011?
I'm advised the actual hard drive, after it was determined and that with experts no emails could be retrieved, was recycled and destroyed in the normal process.
So was it physically destroyed?
That's my understanding.
So was it melted down? Do you know?
I have no idea what the recycler does with it. This was 3 years ago.
Does the IRS have a system for tracking items?
Tracking what?
Items. Does the IRS have a tracking system for items?
We track items. We don't track every item that everybody has everywhere, but I'm sure we track some items. We track.
Does someone there have a serial number for that hard drive?
I do not know whether they do or not. I am just advised that as a normal case, when the hard drive fails, if the email cannot be reconstructed, the hard drive is turned over to recyclers.
Well, it seems to me that if it was recycled, the government property would have been tracked.
Pardon?
It seems to me that if it was recycled, government property would have been tracked, or people could simply walk away with property from the IRS. So I assume there's a tracking system for the disposal of government property.
Right. There's a tracking system for computers. My understanding is that Lois Lerner's computer continued to be functioning with a new hard drive. The hard drive fits with inside. I'm not aware whether hard drives have identifiers.
Can we get the serial number of this hard drive and all the other employees whose emails have been lost?
If they have serial numbers, you're welcome to them.
All right. I want that hard drive, and I want the hard drive of every computer that crashed during that time frame. So, you know, what I've learned in the last week, I think, calls into question every document and response the IRS has given, or for that matter, has failed to give in this committee. And the only way I can see any hope of restoring any confidence is to establish a special prosecutor with the authorities, the powers, and the resources needed to uncover the truth. So for the sake of the agency and to restore the trust of the American people, will you support the appointment of a special prosecutor?
There are 6 investigations going on of this event.
Yes or no?
The IG is already investigating
them. Can you give a definitive answer to this committee? Yes or no, do you support the appointment of a special prosecutor?
I do.
I'm controlling the time. I'm asking a question that can have a simple yes or no answer.
I think the appointment of a special prosecutor after the 6 investigations ongoing and the IG investigation into this matter ongoing would be a monumental waste of taxpayer funds.
So is that a yes or a no?
That's a no.
Thank you. Mr. Levin is recognized. So, yeah, copies will be made available to every member of the committee, so without objection, so ordered. Mr. Ryan's recognized for 5 minutes.
This is unbelievable. The apology that ought to be given is to the American taxpayer, not to a government agency that is abusing its power. I am sitting here listening to this testimony. I don't believe it. That's your problem. Nobody believes you.
Come on now.
The Internal Revenue Service comes to Congress a couple years ago and misleads us and says no targeting is occurring. Then it said it was a few rogue agents in Cincinnati. Then it said it was also on progressives. All of those things have been proven untrue. This committee sent a criminal referral of possible criminal wrongdoing just a month ago to the Justice Department. We've heard nothing. You bury in a 27-page letter to the Senate asking for them to conclude the investigation that you've lost Lois Lerner's emails during the time in question because of a hard drive crash. Monday, our investigators ask your agency whether any other hard drives crashed, and we learned that six other hard drives of the people we're investigating were involved. You didn't tell us that.
We told you on Monday.
On Monday.
And what did you do with the
information? Because we asked you.
Right, and what did you do with that information?
You told us on Monday because we asked you whether any other hard drives crashed. This is unbelievable.
We answered
you told us on May that you were going to give us all of Lois Lerner's emails, and you learned in February that this crashed.
I did not learn in February it was a crash, and we told you on Monday.
I'm not asking you a question. I'm just making a statement.
My apologies.
You are the Internal Revenue Service. You can reach into the lives of hardworking taxpayers, and with a phone call, an email, or a letter, you can turn their lives upside down. You ask taxpayers to hang on to 7 years of their personal tax information in case they're ever audited, and you can't keep 6 months' worth of employee emails? And now that we are seeing this investigation, you don't have the emails. Hard drives crashed. You learned about this months ago. You just told us, and we had to ask you on Monday. This is not being forthcoming. This is being misleading again. This is a pattern of abuse, a pattern of behavior that is not giving us any confidence that this agency is being impartial. I don't believe you. This is incredible.
I have a long career. That's the first time anybody has said that you do not believe me.
I don't believe you.
That's fine. We can have a disagreement. I'm willing to stand on our record. I'm willing to remind you that it was not buried in 27 pages. Most of that 27 pages is exhibits. When asked about the custodians, we advised you what
being
we
knew, forthcoming,
which we knew for one day.
Being forthcoming is to say,
I'm sorry.
You know what, investigators, Congress, who's investigating this?
Will you let him answer the question?
I didn't ask him a question.
Yes, you did.
Being forthcoming.
The gentleman.
I control the time.
I realize that disrupting a hearing sort of...
No, come on.
No.
People, but the gentleman from Wisconsin...
I am not yielding time. I control the time.
He has a time.
Here's what being forthcoming is.
Regular order.
If we are investigating criminal wrongdoing, targeting of people based on their political beliefs, and the emails in question are lost because of a hard drive crash that is apparently unrecoverable, which a lot of IT professionals would question, and you don't tell us about it until we ask you about it, that is not being forthcoming.
And that's true.
I yield back the balance of my time.
That's not true.
The gentleman yields back. The gentleman has yielded back his time.
Thank you.
Mr. Neal is recognized.
Well, I'm actually going to let you answer Mr. Ryan's question. Go ahead.
Right. Mr. Ryan tried to lead the impression that only by being asked did we reveal the information about the hard drive crash. First of all, I would reiterate, the information about the hard drive crash is in the emails that you and your staff have had for some time. Secondly, we produced that public report telling you about the email loss on our own. It was not in response to a question. Third, we learned on Monday morning about the custodians. We were asked, our staff was asked on Monday afternoon. We told them all we knew, which was there was an indication there had been a hard drive problem with six others. The next morning, this committee put out a release asserting, leaping to the conclusion that, therefore, emails had been lost, particularly Nicole Flax's emails. It turns out, as we've continued to work, and we have more work to do, that there's no evidence that any Nicole Flax email was lost. We are responding. What we are trying to do, as the Treasury letter suggested, is as soon as we are able to give you a full picture of it, we are providing that. It's not in response to a question. That was a public report we provided you. We will continue to provide you documents. You have 770,000 pages. You will have 67,000 Lois Lerner emails. 24,000 of Lois Lerner emails in the period when it crashed have not been lost. They will be produced to you.
Mr. Neal, on this point, may I ask you a question? May I ask a question here in your time, and I'll give you some more time. There is a distinction. Yes, the committee did know about the hard drive, but we did not know about the server. There is a distinction. We did not know about the server. And the server, what was came in the carbon copy of the letter you sent to the Senate. The server means they're lost forever. A hard drive crash doesn't necessarily mean that the emails are lost forever. So there is a significant distinction here that has not been made yet to date. So, Mr. Neal, you have, I'll make sure you have more time.
Would you like to respond?
You may, yes.
And that's an important question, and one of the reasons that we did not immediately say we discovered a hard drive crash, because as you just noted, a hard drive crash does not mean that emails have been lost forever. And in the case of Lois Lerner, 24,000 of her emails were not lost. They have actually been found. They will be produced. You have 5,000 of them already. You'll have 24,000 of them by the end of the month. So when a hard drive crashes, the emails do not necessarily disappear. Her email account, any emails in those accounts, which were the emails we could find in that period, were included and did not crash.
Thank you, Commissioner. Commissioner, I must tell you that based on what we've heard so far today, if you came in here and said you agreed with everything that...